Hello and welcome to What Did I Learn? An 8-part series of short podcasts considering Chapter 11 from the book Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time by Professor Carl Quigley. My learning was prompted through membership of the Telegram-based CTTM, Cutting Through the Matrix Book Club. The powers of financial capitalism had another far-reaching aim, nothing less than to create a world system of financial control in private hands, able to dominate the political system of each country and the economy of the world as a whole. This system was to be controlled in a feudalistic fashion by the central banks of the world, acting in concert by secret agreements arrived at in frequent meetings and conferences. The apex of the system was to be the Bank for International Settlements in Basel, Switzerland, a private bank, owned and controlled by the world's central banks, which were themselves private corporations. Each central bank sought to dominate its government by its ability to control treasury loans, to manipulate foreign exchanges, to influence the level of economic activity in the country, and to influence cooperative politicians by subsequent economic rewards in the business world. Carol Quigley. Tragedy and Hope, Chapter 11, Changing Economic Patterns, page 550. The Pluralist Economy and World Blocks. By 1960, after two world wars, a world depression, and post-war fluctuations, it was clear that a new economic organization for society was needed, and indeed, such was available. Laissez-faire was out as a competitive system, having destroyed itself and, in the process, almost destroyed civilization by its inability to distribute the goods it produced. Monopoly capitalism had assisted in the near disaster, and clearly indicated, especially in fascist countries, that its effort to protect its profits and privileges by authoritarian governments and ultimately by war were unsuccessful. It simply could not combine economic conservatism and social life with the necessary innovation and freedom in military and intellectual life to win any wars which it could start. And at this point, at the top of page 551, Quigley makes what, in my humble opinion, is a truly profound statement of fact, re-communism. I summarize as follows. Despite being on the winning side in World War II, authoritarian communism ultimately demonstrated that as a political economic system, it was wholly incapable of fostering innovation, fostering flexibility, and allowing whatever freedom was necessary to ensure any evolution in standards of living. It survived only on the basis of copying freer peoples relative to their industrial advances. Most of all, it could not combine lack of freedom and force in political life together with any utilization of economic resources, or any increase in production of food, etc. Finally, the withholding of the intellectual and spiritual freedoms from its people contributed majorly to its ultimate demise. The tripartite failure of laissez-faire economics, fascism, and communism to satisfy the demands for a rising standard of living and also for spiritual freedom forced mid-20th century to seek some new economic organization. Quigley observes that the aforementioned demands were intensified by the arrival on the scene of 1. New peoples, 2. New nations, and 3. New tribes who, by their similar demands, have demonstrated the growing awareness of the problems and their determination to do something about said problems. Quigley, however, does not elaborate specifically with regard to precisely who these new peoples, new nations, and new clans are. Quigley now classifies the aforementioned as a new group of underdeveloped people, again, no specifics, and states that they have looked upon and been struck by the conflicting claims of the two great superpowers, that is, the US and the Soviet Union. The US offered rising standards of living and freedom, while the Soviet Union offered state accumulation of capital, government control of economic resources, and central planning, which tended to smother efforts to rise living standards, and indeed to smother freedom. Here then, in my humble opinion, is the money quote from Quigley. 3/4 ways down, page 551, he asserts, "The net result of all of this has been a convergence of all three systems, that is, laissez-faire economics, fascism, and communism, towards a common goal, if remote, system of the future." What can I say? The old dialectic at work once again, eh? Okay, so, you probably had a wow moment there. Well, I'll give you one which gazumps that in its profound chapter and verse form. Here we go. "The ultimate nature of the new system of economic and social life is not yet clear, but we might call it the pluralist economy, and we might characterize its social structure as one which provides prestige, rewards, and power to managerial groups of experts, whose contributions to the system are derived from their expertise and know-how." Boom. Technocracy, anybody? Quigley stresses that managers and experts are a minority in society, therefore an elite. They are recruited from society as a whole and can be selected only from a process of careers open to talent on a trial and error basis. Such will require freedom of assembly, discussion, and decision, so as to produce the innovations needed for future success, or even survival of the system within which they function. Thus, Quigley asserts, the pluralist economy and the managerial society from the early 1940s have forced the growth of a new kind of economic organization, which will be totally different to the four types of pre-1939, that is, US laissez-faire, Stalinist communism, authoritarian fascism, and indeed, whatever is being practiced in the underdeveloped areas. Quigley goes on to enumerate what he describes as the five characteristics of the new pluralist managerial system as follows. 1. The allotment of resources among three claimants, that is, A. Goods to consumers, B. Investment into capital goods, and C. Public sector to cover defense, public order, education, social welfare, and central care administrative activities associated with the young, the old, and with public welfare as a whole. 2. A decision-making element to facilitate within the first characteristic, that is, to deal with the following complex competing demands: A. Defense forces, B. Labor, C. Farmers, D. Heavy industry, E. Light industry, F. Transport and communications, G. Finance, fiscal and banking, H. Commercial, real estate and construction, I. Scientific education and intellectual groups, J. Political party and government workers, and K. Consumers in general. 3. The complex, slow, and almost imperceptible shifts in decision-making in and between the various claimants, shifts which will move from support to neutralism to opposition. For example, if there is an excess of resource allotment in one area, claimants in other areas will react with pressures and demands for increased allotment of resources within their areas. There will be a constant waxing and waning of resource allocation demands from one area to the other. 4. The management of the shifts of resources will be dominated by rationalist and scientific methods, encompassing analytical and quantitative techniques. Considerable freedom of discussion will be required in utilizations everywhere, as in communist states. Authoritarian and secretive methods will be used relative to resource allotments to the various sectors. There will be a very considerable modification of the areas and objectives of freedom in all societies in the world, with a gradual reduction of numerous personal freedoms of the past, accompanied by a gradual increase in intellectual freedom, which will provide technical innovations, that is, the clash of ideas and the release of the personal energies necessary for success, or even for the survival of the modern state system. 5. Operation of this new system will emerge gradually. In the West, it will emerge via shifts in public opinion, shifts in political parties. In the communist bloc, it will become apparent via a smaller group of insiders and on a more personal basis, so that shifts of targets and the direction of travel will be revealed by shifts of personnel in the state's bureaucratic structure. In underdeveloped countries, where power is typically supported by the military, the process may be reflected by changes in policy and direction by existing elite and by rulers retaining power in spite of changing politics. Quigley notes that in the period since 1947, the differences between any two of the three economic blocs has become less, while the three methods of achieving policy shifts, covered earlier, are becoming increasingly similar, both in essence and in fact. However, in the same period, solidarity between the West and the communist bloc has become less, but the unity of outlook, policies and interests of the uncommitted and underdeveloped peoples of the intermediary zone between the two great powers has become increasingly unified. Note the old dialectic in operation yet again. Thesis equals the West, antithesis equals the communist bloc, synthesis equals the uncommitted and underdeveloped bloc, likely via technocracy. Quigley characterizes this new pluralist management system as being one of planning, not necessarily, he says, in any centralized form, but simply concerned with a general scientific method and rational utilization of resources, both of time and space, to achieve consciously envisioned future goals. UN Sustainable Development Goals, aka SDGs, anyone? On the journey into the new process, both Western Europe and Japan came in for praise from Quigley, with the latter chosen because, in the context of an absence of need to devote resources towards defense, such resources were then mobilized instead towards investment, and, as a consequence, Japan's gross national product achievement has been in the order of 7-9% per year. Japan being the only area of the non-Western world and underdeveloped world countries which was able to pass into a higher level of industrialization and as such achieve substantial improvements in individual standards of living. Japanese improvements held back by an emphasis on reconstruction and investment in the period 1945 through 1962 shifted slowly but steadily in the late 1950s and early 1960s towards consumer benefits, including such things as education, sports, leisure and entertainment. Western Europe, Quigley contends, has had a somewhat similar experience to Japan, but with different emphasis, that is, towards improved standard of living and towards development of welfare systems, with more emphasis on defense and less emphasis on investment. As a result of Pax Americana and its implied military protection, Western Europe and especially West Germany, Italy, France, Scandinavia and Britain, for the first time, have come within striking distance of a very high standard of personal consumption found in the US. Quigley states that because of the following three basic forces, Western Europe has achieved GNP growth rates of between 4-8% per year. 1. Skillful and lucky use of financial and fiscal techniques which encouraged both investment and consumption. 2. Economic and technical aid from the US, beginning with the Marshall Plan, and including military aid and indeed the investment of savings coming in from the entire Western world. And 3. The growing integration of Europe's economy as exemplified by the emergence of the European Common Market, which made it feasible to adopt mass production techniques for a greatly enlarged market. Quigley notes that in similar circumstance and in economic context, the achievements of the US and indeed the Soviet bloc have been much less spectacular. So, what were the holdback factors within the US? Well, despite the very high levels of affluence and standard of living achieved, the burden of being a superpower hampered welfare because of the conflicting claims of defence, government expenses, prestige and other rivalries, with, of course, the Soviet Union acting as the military threat bogeyman, and indeed, because of the desire to contribute to the growth of the underdeveloped world. Quigley notes that growth rates of GNP in the US have only been between 2 and 5% per year, and the burden of the government sector, including defence, and increasing demands for such welfare items as education, health, and the equalisation of personal opportunities together have put significant pressure on growth in the consumer sector. The Soviet bloc as a whole has been ambiguous in terms of economic growth. Demands of defence and other Cold War interests, such as the space race, combined with continuous failures of communist agricultural practices and the intrinsic inefficiency of the communist system to limit severely any rise in standards of living. Quigley acknowledges that the standard of living within the Soviet Union itself had reached the highest it had ever been in Russia. However, Russia still lagged significantly behind at only a fraction of the standard of living of the US. Apparently, the non-Russian countries within the Soviet bloc had been exploited by the Soviet Union and were treated as if colonial areas. As such, they had achieved little, if any, increase in GNP beyond what was needed to sustain their own populations. In the more western part of the Soviet bloc, for example, in East Germany, Hungary and Poland, the failure of the communist system has been reflected more strongly in the form of an absolute decline in living standards, with the consequential sharp contrast between this and the visible boom in West Germany. There has arisen a discontent in the Soviet bloc European satellites. With respect to the so-called underdeveloped nations, Quigley has this to say: as a whole, lack of know-how and trained manpower, lack of capital, waste of resources by small privileged elites, absolute shortages of resources in some areas, and rapid growth in populations almost everywhere, and hopelessly unprogressive social structures and ideologies combine to prevent much, if any, improvement in standards of living. In fact, Quigley points out that economic conditions conducive to the bettering of standards of living have in fact been decreasing in much of Indonesia and the Near East and Latin America, and have managed only slightly to keep ahead of the economic matters in, for example, India, Southeast Asia and Africa. Interesting to note, Quigley's observation here, that is, only in Japan, as we have seen, has there been success, while a failure of these desires in China and in Latin America have tended to lead both of these areas away from their former alignment with the Soviet and Western blocs towards a more ambivalent political position, which they now hold as uncommitted areas. Quigley closes by stating that China's enmity towards both the Soviet Union and the US has tended to place it in a new position, that is, outside the pre-1962 alignments of international politics, while Latin America's growing discontent has tended to lead it, from many points of view, towards the position of the Near East. And that, dear listeners, concludes the 8 parts of Chapter 11, Tragedy and Hope. Thank you. And there's more, much more. Why not check out the Alan Watt CCTM channel on YouTube, where Melissa regularly presents Redux material from the late great Alan Watt, and in addition presents her own ever-interesting real history programs. In addition, also on YouTube, you have the very excellent Hayes Reviews channel, where you can enjoy full online readings and genial host interactions relative to a huge range of truly significant books. Books which reveal truth relative to history from the very pens of movers and shakers of bygone eras. They may be gone, but to this day, we are living a dark legacy of their anti-human plans and schemes, which are being actualized by their intergenerational ideological devotees and collaborators. I hope you have found the information which was presented here to have been both interesting and indeed educational. Thank you for your time and attention, and please do check out the other 7 podcasts in this mini-series.